All right. The Chief Judge and the judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and its honorable court.
Please be seated. Colonel Christensen, Major Porterfield, Major Carl, Mr. Sullivan, good morning. I understand, Major Porterfield, that you are reserving 7 minutes, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And welcome back.
Thank you.
Are you prepared to argue?
Yes, ma'am.
And Major Kerr, are you prepared to argue?
Yes, ma'am.
Major Porterfield, you may start. And just for the record, we're having the case of the United States versus Airman First Class Hawthorne, an Article 62 appeal.
May it please the court. I am Major Naomi Porterfield, and I, along with Colonel Don Christensen, represent the United States in this matter. At the outset, I think it's important to clarify the issue before the court. Both the military judge and appellee in his attempt to reframe the government's appeal, I think have somewhat confused the issue arising from the facts of this case. And so to that end, we'd like to point out one crucial fact that we feel the court should consider in resolving at least the first aspect of the issue in this case. And that is to invoke the exclusionary rule and require dismissal with prejudice under Castigar, a statement cannot be considered immunized unless it was made under the impression that it would not be used against its maker. And appellee was under no such impression in this case. This is not a case where the appellee, the accused, asked for immunity. It's not a case where there were any promises or assurances made that his statements wouldn't be used against him. From the beginning, this was a simple case of hip pocket immunity. Now, as the record makes clear at 581 and 582, the immunity at issue here was obtained just in case appellant invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Now, it's important, I think, to understand the difference between the technical question of when an immunity becomes valid based on the words used or the date that's listed, and when it invokes the exclusionary rule, whether that statement is immunized. In all aspects of American jurisprudence, we grant the protections of the exclusionary rule under the Fifth Amendment when a statement is coerced, when it's unlawfully induced, when it's compelled. And to be sure, the immunity statutes were created to balance the protections given to the individual citizen under the Fifth Amendment and the right of the government to compel statements. That's where the immunity statutes came into play, in order to create that balance, to resolve the tension. Now, here what we have is a finding where there's no impression, there's no promise, there's no assurance to an accused that his statements wouldn't be used against him. On the contrary, the trial counsel in this case specifically informed the accused that his statements would be used against him, that he had the right to remain silent, that he had the right to request a lawyer. And the accused waived those rights and made a statement. And so when you look at the case law where the government or the courts, I should say, have excluded the testimony or have dismissed with prejudice under Castigar, those cases all involve some reliance by the accused on a promise from the government or a government representative. All of those cases, Chernovic, Sapkowski, all of them rely. And even the case relied upon by appellee, Wayne. In that case, they dealt with the issue of the order and its validity by the convening authority, but it turned on the promise that was made from the trial counsel in that case. And so when you, even when you have a situation as is present in this case where you have an order from the convening authority dated before the accused statement, there is still a situation where the court takes into account the reliance by the accused. And there is no such reliance in this case. And therefore, the statement can't be considered immunized invoking the exclusionary rule.
Okay. Counsel, this seems to be somewhat of a case of first impression from the standpoint that it hasn't been addressed in the case law except other than the old Army Board case cited by the appellee regarding, you know, when does the immunity take effect? The rule 704 does not address it, and so there's this silence out there. And how do you explain that? Why, especially when in light of the facts, the memo that went up to the convening authority had requested that the immunity take effect upon receipt. The convening authority put no conditions on the grant of immunity. Just says the immunity is hereby granted in your order to testify. So there was no effective date per se, other than the convening authority granted the immunity on whatever it was, the 3rd, and then the accused was interviewed the next day. So how do you address that, other than your argument that it wasn't otherwise compelled?
Certainly, Your Honor. Well, I probably have a multi-pronged response to the question. With respect to the case being one of first impression, certainly the United States would agree that this set of facts is not resolved by any one case in particular, particularly on resolving the question of when a letter of immunity takes effect. And so to that extent, yes, it is a case of first impression. However, in looking at the effective date, I think it's interesting that the court will point out the fact that, yes, the routing papers that went up along with or to the convening authority and the request for a grant of immunity indicated that this was in an effort to obtain HIPAA immunity. This was just in case the accused would invoke. Now, of course, as we know, the letter signed by the convening authority didn't include that language. However, what is glaringly absent from the memo, or the order, I should say, from the convening authority is effective immediately, or there's no effective language in there. And so to the extent that this language is absent, I don't think that the court should take that to mean it's effective immediately. If anything, I hereby grant you is indicative of it being effective when the recipient reads the letter, because the letter is between the convening authority and the accused. That's who it's written to. It's not written to the legal office.
Yes, but the convening authority is the one that has the power to grant.
Yes, Your Honor. And to that point, what I would say is, and I think the appellee relies heavily on that, the sole discretion language in 704. Certainly, the 704 makes clear that the convening authority has sole discretion. But I think if sole discretion, that phrase, was as clear as appellee argues it to be, then de facto immunity wouldn't exist. Because in some cases, the courts have recognized that, like Cook v. Orser, for example, which started that line of cases, that someone other than the convening authority can grant immunity when there is reliance, among other things. But when there is detrimental reliance by the accused, based on a promise made. It's something that keeps going back to that promise made, that detrimental reliance. To invoke something as powerful as dismissing a case with prejudice, or even the exclusionary rule, there has to be compulsion of some kind. And so to the extent that the plain language is relied upon by the appellee or this court, I think the answer is twofold. One, the plain language is not as clear as to completely resolve this issue. If anything, it leaves us with questions.
Hold on, counsel. The trial counsel or the SJA made a request for HIPAA immunity, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
How are we not to read this other than do it now? Because if you look at the 5th April letter to Senior Airman Flanner, that's a little different. That's a request for HIPAA immunity as well, and it says this grant of immunity in order to testify takes effect upon receipt. So clearly the convening authority knows how to distinguish the two.
Well, Your Honor,
so how are they not different?
Well, I think one has to read the entire record in order to glean why they're not different. If you look at the 14 February, something that was made subsequent, grant of immunity for Airman Foley, that is identical to the language that was in the immunity granted to Airman Hawthorne. And if you look later, after some cases had passed and after this issue had become, had obviously created some confusion there at the base, they added that sentence right at the bottom of paragraph 3. And so what I think, what I would ask the court not to do is put form over substance here. Clearly, I don't, there's nothing in the record that would indicate the convening authority himself took action in making sure that he wanted Airman Flannan to receive hip pocket immunity and not Airman Hawthorne. What seems to be the case is the legal office, having been made aware of the confusion that arose from the incident with Airman Hawthorne or Airman Flannan, his case taking place prior to that 9 April or that 5 April grant of immunity, tried to minimize the extent to which this further became an issue and added that language at the end of the boilerplate language that was otherwise identical to all three of the grants of immunity.
Well, counsel, isn't it in the record when the SJA, when the trial counsel first came in and told the SJA, this is what I'm doing, I'm going to read them the rights and not give them their immunity grant, wasn't her reaction, whoa, can we do that?
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, didn't she have some qualms about what was going on there, that, you know, they had this immunity but they weren't giving it to the accused?
Well, to first respond to your question, the government would point out that to the extent there's any discomfort with trial counsel's delay in giving the accused a grant of immunity, it would go more to the issue of voluntariness rather than the issue of whether this is a compelled immunized statement. But to answer your question more directly, the confusion that existed in the legal office, I think, is of no consequence in determining whether this was in fact an immunized statement, because the record makes clear going up to the convening authority that was the goal. And so Colonel Crum, I believe is who you're talking about, the 12th SJA, was slightly concerned about whether he would be able to charge. And from reading the record as a whole, it would appear that he was just concerned whether there was otherwise existing evidence in case the accused actually did invoke his right and his confession wouldn't be used against him. He was concerned that they would not be able to prosecute him absent his confession. I believe that answers your question.
Well,
but
it just seemed to me that this issue about when the immunity was effective or whether they had to give it to the accused prior to questioning him, it certainly didn't appear to be clear to them. They wondered, and then ultimately it took the form of a later grant of immunity. They actually put it in the grant that, you know, effective upon receipt, and actually had the witness have to sign it.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Are you just saying that they were just being overly cautious, or?
Well, at the maximum, I would say certainly that's the case, but they were cautious about how to proceed. I mean, let's be clear about how these things take place. Obviously, there are lots of procedures involved, and as Your Honor pointed out, the procedure's not made clear in RCM 704. So the guidance to the field, I think, would create some confusion about whether they should or should not do that. The procedure section in RCM 704, 704D, doesn't give much. What it does tell us is that a person who has received immunity should have X, Y, and Z. The analysis tells us that the rule was created to resolve misunderstandings between the parties. What it doesn't tell us is about how to effectuate the grant of immunity, when to designate its effective date. I think it's clear when you're looking at Marilyn v. Schatzer or Moran versus Bovine, I think it's clear that the reason sometimes statutes or cases don't want to create these set of rules, these singular set of rules to apply to all the bases, is because it alleviates the practical considerations that could arise in any one given case. And so, to some extent, the general officer is not going to be involved in the practical implications of his grant of immunity, how it's going to take effect. And so sometimes these statutes have to be vague or ambiguous to that extent. But I think if anything, Your Honor, to be
looking at this, how are we to read that the legal office made a recommendation for hip pocket immunity and the jail decided, no, I want it done now?
Your Honor, to answer your question, I would have to disagree with the second part, because there is no indication, at least from the United States perspective, that the general officer said, I want it done now. He could have said, effective immediately. What he did say was, I grant you, Airman Hawthorne, immunity. And that has to be effective if you're applying contract principles upon Airman Hawthorne's receipt, upon his reading. And so
why do you need this language? Then why do you need this last sentence when you talk about Senior Airman Flanagan? Why do you need it?
For the same reasons we cited earlier, Your Honor, that it was following the raising of this issue in a previous case, and it was the legal office's response to try to minimize any confusion. And again, this sort of goes back to Judge Weiss's question about why there was confusion in the legal office. There is limited guidance in the RCM, and sometimes the RCMs don't give the base legal offices all the information they need to make it as clean cut. Is there a better way to do it? Is the Flanner way the better way to do it? Perhaps this court could feel that way. However, does it invoke the exclusionary rule? Is this a compelled statement? That's the question before this court today. And counsel, there's no evidence that that's the case. Yes, Your Honor.
In the request for the grant for testimonial immunity, they asked to have it be effective upon receipt. Does it matter what they asked for? Is that important?
Well, Your Honor,
what if that language hadn't been there? Would we be having a different argument?
I don't think it matters with respect to the immunized testimony, only because from the government's perspective, there's no compulsion here. And if you look at Moran, the issue's resolved, there's no compulsion, and so there should be no dismissal with prejudice. However, to the extent that this court is uncomfortable with trial counsel's actions and wants to consider that question on the issue of voluntariness, I think it is a relevant consideration. However, I don't think it's ultimately dispositive, because it doesn't go to the state of mind of the accused.
What about this? The convening authority, a three-star general, basically says, I'm granting immunity, and I hereby order you to answer questions. Now, the convening authority, wasn't he really expecting his staff to communicate that order? What authority did he give the captain trial counsel to decide, I'm not going to give this order or communicate this order to the accused? What about that? Did he have that authority?
Well, Your Honor, I would probably say that in response to Judge Brand's question, the relevance of the paperwork that went up would somehow respond to your question. I would encourage the court to take that into consideration. However, the convening authority, the three-star, as we all know, isn't involved in the day-to-day operations. What I do believe is that if he was under the impression, or if it was his goal to make sure that it was given to Airman Hawthorne immediately, then he could have said as much. This appears,
so we should speculate as to
certainly,
what he
was
thinking?
Certainly, Your Honor. We don't feel that the court should speculate. But to read effective immediately into the contract, into the memorandum from the convening authority, would also be speculation, because those words don't exist in there. So what Your Honor seems to be looking at is the RCM and the sole discretion. Yes, the convening authority has the sole discretion to grant immunity. But what it doesn't say is the rule doesn't preclude how that immunity takes effect. When that immunity takes effect, it doesn't preclude hip pocket immunity, something in the context of statutory immunity that has existed for quite some time in the civilian sector.
So it was okay for the captain trial counsel to basically decide when and if he was going to communicate the general's order?
Well, to be clear, Your Honor, I don't think this is a case of a rogue captain trial counsel. I think this was, from the beginning, an attempt to overcome the accused anticipated invocation, as is made clear in the record, as is made clear in the memorandum attached to the convening or sent up to the convening authority in the request. So to that extent, I don't think this is a rogue child counsel saying, oh, I'm just going to take it upon myself not to do what the convening authority directed me to do. But what I would also say, Your Honor, is to the extent that this court is in any way uncomfortable with the trial counsel's actions, it certainly doesn't answer the question of whether the statement was compelled. And to that extent, I would point the court to Moran v. Burbine. In that case, the court dealt with this issue with a police officer interfering with an attorney's attempt to communicate with his client. And in that case, which from the United States perspective was more egregious than the facts of this case, the court there even said, okay, it probably wasn't the best thing to do, but it was a matter of ethics because it had no impact on the accused's perspective because he didn't know. He didn't know that the attorney was there. He independently waived his rights. He independently did not make a statement thinking it would not be used against him. So when you're looking at both of these questions, the question of voluntariness and the question of whether this was a compelled statement, the issue, while this court may have an ethical problem with what the trial counsel did, it has no bearing. It has no bearing on the accused perspective on why he made the statement. And going back to Marilyn v. Schatzer and the other aspects of Moran v. Burbine, we have to look at that purpose, the purpose of the protections of the Fifth Amendment, the purpose of Article 31 and Moran, and the immunity statutes to protect against the right against self-incrimination, to protect against coerced or compelled statements. And there are no compelled or coerced statements in this case. If there are no further questions on the issue of immunity, I'll touch briefly on the voluntariness question.
Go ahead.
At the outset, I probably begin by distinguishing knowing and intelligent from voluntary. And the Supreme Court in Moran v. Burbine did a good job of differentiating between the two. What is clear is that Miranda and Article 31 were created in an effort to make a clear-cut set of rules that would overcome the knowing and intelligent. To the extent that an accused was advised of his rights and advised of the consequences of waiving those rights, then that accused had made a knowing and intelligent waiver. So to the extent that this court found that the accused was made aware that he had the right to remain silent, was made aware of the right to request an attorney, and was made aware that the statements he would make would be used against him, then the statement was knowing and intelligent. In terms of voluntariness, the totality of the circumstances test applied by the military judge below doesn't fall in line with any of the factors that the court, that our superior court, has framed in answering the question of the totality of the circumstances and the question of voluntariness. What is clear here is that this was a situation where the accused was calm, he was cooperative, he knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his right. So he made a statement. Yes, he didn't know about the immunity. He didn't know. Could that have changed his mind? Well, the opposite couldn't have been true. If they had given him the grant of immunity, that would be the end of it. Certainly, they couldn't give him the grant of immunity and then read him a rights advisement. I see that my time has expired. I can answer any additional questions on rebuttal.
Thank you. Major Kerr. Major Kerr?
Chief Judge Brand, members of this honorable court, this is a case about command authority, and the government's argument is centered around limiting that command authority. But this is not a contract, and this is not a civilian jurisdiction. We're in the military, and the commanders drive the military. Colonel Bechtold did not abuse her discretion when she upheld the grant of immunity by the 12th Air Force commander, Lieutenant General Spears. Colonel Bechtold recognized that RCM 704 C3 and E were promulgated by the President of the United States that granted the authority to grant immunity to commanders, not to attorneys, not to trial counsel, but to general court-martial convening authority commanders. Now, there are those within the civilian jurisdiction that suggest that it should be otherwise, that perhaps civilians should be bestowed, with that perhaps attorneys or trial counsels should be bestowed with this authority, the way it's done within the civilian jurisdiction. But we're in the military, and to emphasize just how much authority is given to commanders in this situation, RCM 704 states that this is within the sole discretion of the convening authority to grant immunity, and that this authority can be granted to no one else. It can be delegated to no one else.
Well, counsel, using that logic, if somebody gets a commander to get a command-directed urinalysis, and you call in the accused or the suspect or whatever, and you ask them to voluntarily consent to a urinalysis, that consent's not valid? Because you have a command directed sitting in your desk drawer that you will use if you have to, but you're asking for consent. But a commander signed that command directed piece of paper. So you're saying that usurps getting consent from the accused when you ask them to do a urinalysis?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, I'm not seeing the difference between the two. Both commanders, you're telling me commanders have the ultimate authority, and once a commander says it's so, it's so.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, what's the difference?
In this situation, it's obviously an immunity. In your situation, you're talking about an order. In the situation that you're speaking of, where they ask the accused for consent initially, that's a situation where the accused has lost rights through that order. And to the extent, not a situation like this where the accused has gained rights through the grant of immunity.
Well, actually, hasn't he lost rights to keep his mouth shut?
Say again, Your Honor.
Hasn't he lost the right to keep his mouth shut?
In this situation.
In the grant of immunity, you say he's gained a right. No, he's lost the right to not talk. He's being ordered to talk.
Well, yes, Your Honor. As Colonel Bechtold points out in her decision, the grant of immunity from the order to participate in the investigation are two separate acts by the convening authority. So the grant of immunity is not necessarily tied to the order. So I would see the request for consent in your analysis being different in the sense that perhaps the commander would be upset with that situation, but we're not looking at a situation where that individual is depriving the person in that situation in the command-directed urinalysis of an actual right, where in this situation the trial counsel is denying the Airman Hawthorne of a right in this case. Now, the government's argued that there's some sort of reliance necessary on the part of the accused. But this is simply not the case, and again, this is an attempt to limit the commander's authority. Under the Lane case, it was not the accused that relied upon the convening authority's grant of immunity. Rather, that information had been conveyed to the father of the accused, and there's no indication that the accused in that case was ever aware of that grant of immunity, yet he still benefited from that grant of immunity. Again, this is a unilateral act under Jones. There is no requirement that the accused be aware or participate in the grant of immunity.
Of course, there was an additional distinguishing fact in Lane, was there not, regarding that when Lane took the stand to testify as a witness, he was not advised of his Article 31 rights. So, in essence, his statement was compelled because they all considered him a suspect, yet he wasn't read his rights.
Yes, Your Honor.
In addition to the fact that the defense counsel for the accused intimated that he had immunity, so there was some, he had some awareness that there may have been immunity. In addition, his testimony was not advised prior to. So there are some distinguishing considerations in Lane to the extent it has any persuasive guidance on this court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because looking at this, it says the record indicates that the accused was misled and lulled into a belief that he would not be prosecuted for the offenses. So it appears that the judges in this case thought he knew about it when he testified.
In the Lane case, Your Honor?
Yes.
Yes, the language specifically that I'm looking at, the Lane case, states that it's not necessary that an immunity be delivered in order for it to take effect. Additionally, the language states that the father was the one guaranteed the immunity.
But it appears that what they decided this case on was the fact that he knew when he got on the stand to testify, he knew or he believed, rightly or wrongly, that there was some form of, he wasn't going to trial. He understood that he would not be prosecuted for the offenses.
Yes, Your Honor.
Rightly or wrongly, he thought, that's what he thought.
Yes, Your Honor. So there are obviously distinguishing factors between the Lane case.
Well, in this case, even though the accused didn't testify, he knew nothing about immunity at all.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But just as in the Ivy case, where CAF found that it would be improper for a trial counsel or an SJA not to deliver a request for immunity to the community authority, it's just as improper in this case for immunity to be granted and then trial counsel to refuse to provide that grant of immunity to Aaron Hawthorne in this case. There's two particular items that need to be interpreted in this case. First, there's RCM 704 that requires interpretation. And second, there's also the grant of immunity that requires interpretation. This court should use plain language interpretation when determining how to read and understand these documents. There's extensive military case law that states that we interpret the manuals for court-martials by its plain language. And when the plain language is clear, there's no duty for further interpretation. Here it's clear that the commander has sole discretion and that he cannot delegate that authority to the trial counsel. Second, this court should also use plain language when determining how to interpret the grant of immunity. Now, the government suggested in its brief that perhaps this is a difficult case because this is a case of first impression where there's no case law out there to help this court interpret the grant of immunity. But there's no need for extensive case law to interpret the plain language of a document. When the convening authority writes that he hereby grants immunity to Airman Hawthorne, that language is open to one interpretation, that he is granting immunity by signing that document, as found by Colonel Bechtold in her rulings and findings in this case. Now, to the extent that this court feels that it should look to other case law in interpreting this grant of immunity, this court should look to the case law surrounding actions by convening authorities. And we know that when convening authorities take action in a case, that as long as the language in the action is clear and unambiguous, that those actions should be given their full effect. And by full effect, we mean that we don't look to other sources in order to interpret the plain language within that action. And here, in this case, the government suggests that perhaps we should look to trial counsel's intentions, to the recommendation as it was forwarded up, the SJA's intentions, the wing commander's intentions, perhaps even 12th Air Force commander's intentions. But if we did that in this case, it again undermines the commander in this case and opens up to second guessing in any and all similar cases.
So it would be your position that if this letter on 3 February was signed by the general and never delivered to the base, never left the general's office, he'd still have immunity?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that that appellee has to take that extreme of a position in this case. I think the answer is yes. It is a unilateral act by the convening authority that he has the sole discretion for granting. He doesn't have to rely upon his trial counsel or his staff for granting that immunity, but this court doesn't have to take that position in this case because what we have is a trial counsel who failed, even if it was upon delivery, we had a trial counsel who felt that he had the ability to usurp the commander's authority and not deliver the grant of immunity in that case.
What if Hawthorne would have all of a sudden you decided, gee, this is weighing on me, I'm going to be testifying against my friend, I want to fess up. So he goes over to the OSI and just voluntarily confesses. But the immunity grant had been signed unbeknownst to him. So what happens in that situation? Is he protected against his voluntary confession?
Yes, Your Honor.
Nobody asked him anything. He just went in on his own.
Again, Your Honor, obviously that's a different situation than we have here. And this court doesn't have to find that in order to...
But in essence, are we finding that by... If the grant of immunity takes effect, in other words, as soon as the community authority assigns it, Hawthorne was cloaked in immunity from that point. Don't we have to look and consider that situation when we draft a decision in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, that's one possibility. And in that sense, again, RCM 704 states that the ability to grant immunity is within the sole discretion of the community authority. We don't have to look to his reasons for granting immunity, but it's most importantly that we don't limit his authority, that we don't limit the 12th Air Force Commander's ability to grant immunity. And if he has a reason to grant immunity to someone in an expedited manner where he cannot deliver that immunity immediately, he has the authority from the President to do so.
So in the example I related, you would say Hawthorne would have had immunity under those circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor. But we have a case that goes further than that here, where we have trial counsel, again, holding on to the immunity, interfering with that grant of immunity in a way that's okay, not...
Which case was that?
Say again, Your Honor.
You had cited a case earlier for the proposition that the prosecutor interfering.
Oh, there's a case. It was cited in citation of authority by Appley, and it's the Ivy case from CAF, Your Honor.
What is it? I'm sorry?
Ivy.
Okay.
And as this court has already pointed out, if the commander wanted this to be effective upon receipt, he could have put that in there, but he didn't. It is not in there, and it is not in there. We also potentially have a question about whether Airman Hawthorne's statements fall within the scope of immunity, even assuming that he does have immunity. But we know that trial counsel and the SJA both believed that his statements fell within the scope of this grant of immunity. The SJA had a discussion with the wing commander concerned about whether it fell in, and she assured him that it did, but they could still prosecute Airman Hawthorne based on Mr. Roberti's, Airman Flanner, and Airman Foley's immunized testimony. And trial counsel was preparing the week of February 4th and the week of February 4th for the U.S. v. Foley case the following week. So we know that trial counsel stated that he was interested, both Captain Korzak and Captain Countryman stated that they were interested in interviewing Airman Hawthorne in this case because they were the trial counsel in U.S. v. Foley preparing for that case. We knew that they interviewed him because they were concerned about Mr. Roberti's reliability, and so they brought him in to see what he could substantiate related to the United States v. Foley case and whether Mr. Roberti would be reliable upon the stand. But besides just the intentions and understandings of trial counsel and the SJA that Airman Hawthorne's statements fell within the scope of the immunized testimony, the facts also show that his statements fell within immunized testimony. We know that Airman Hawthorne told Captain Korzak that he'd been pulled in to the party scene by Airman Foley, that Roberti was the supplier of drugs to both of them, that they were both roommates, that Hawthorne had already, and Hawthorne along the way had already been extensively involved in this case. So through these things, all of this information could be used in preparation for an investigation during findings or during sentencing during the U.S. v. Foley case. Now, the government also suggests that the remedy in this case is perhaps not appropriate. But when you apply Castigar and when you apply Mapes and you understand, when you apply Castigar and Mapes, it's clear that Colonel Bechtel was acting within the appropriate spectrum for granting the sanction of dismissing this case with prejudice. The government fails on all four prongs under Mapes, When Aaron Hawthorne spoke with Captain Korzak and Captain Countryman, they knew very little about his involvement with drug use. They only knew that Mr. Roberti had said that he'd seen Aaron Hawthorne use cocaine. So, under the first prong, Aaron Hawthorne provided substantial amount of additional information that was incriminating towards him, which included the location of the drug use, that Mr. Roberti had supplied the cocaine, that Aaron Hawthorne had been drinking at the time, that this was a one-time use, and he also talked about the effect and the manner of the use. The government fails under the second prong under MAPES because the investigation had not even formally begun. The most that had been done is Aaron Hawthorne's name had been put on a list for potential court-martials there at Holloman Air Force Base. So the investigation had not been completed for Aaron Hawthorne at the time that he made a statement on the 4th of February. The military judge found in her findings of fact that Aaron Hawthorne's statement on the 4th of February was used in determining whether to prefer and refer this case to trial. And lastly, the military judge also found that the trial counsel in U.S. v. Foley participated in the investigation in the trial of Aaron Hawthorne because they provided their notes and their complete case file to the trial counsel in Aaron Hawthorne's case. So the government failed on all four prongs under U.S. v. MAPES.
Well, if you back things up.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you look at it from the standpoint of the government had some evidence that Airman Hawthorne may have used drugs.
Yes, Your Honor.
But they called him in on the 3rd.
Yes, Your Honor.
From going that point backward, going from what they knew at that point in time when they called him in to talk, assuming that his statements are inadmissible, how does it meet the standard that it must be dismissed with prejudice? Because you have some evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not a very strong case, but you still have some evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. They still fail under all four prongs, Your Honor. Captain Countryman went to interview. The information they got was from Mr. Roberti, who was in drug rehabilitation at the time of the interview.
I understand all that, but the point is the government's got plenty of trial counsel. If you just draw a line right there, get new counsel, and press on, new convening authority, why can't the government proceed?
Well, if they had done that, Your Honor, that would be appropriate.
No, but why can't they do that now?
They can't do that now because they never created a Chinese wall around Captain Countryman or Captain Korzak. All this information is out there for the convening authority, for Aaron Hawthorne's trial counsel. There's no one who's capable of passing along that information who has been protected from those immunized statements. Anybody who would receive that would only be receiving the information from people who knew about Aaron Hawthorne's immunized statements. And under United States v. Dooley, which was also a Article 62 appeal where CAF overruled the Navy Marine Corps Court of Appeal for finding that the military judge's sanction in a speedy trial motion were too extreme, CAF found that there's a spectrum of sanctions by a military judge, and as long as that decision falls within the spectrum, that sanction should not be altered.
Counsel, I want to go back to the issue of the voluntariness of Hawthorne's statement. The trial judge found that the fact that there had been a grant of immunity waiting out there, even if it wasn't effective yet, the fact that it was there was a critical component that the trial counsel had a duty to inform Hawthorne with his Article 31 rights, and that failing to do so in the totality of circumstances made his confession involuntary or coerced. She cited no case law in support of that. It seems to be a rather unique view of the law. Can you explain and justify the judge's position there with any case law?
Yes, Your Honor. It is a unique position, Your Honor. And the only case law that I can point this court to is Moran v. Burbine, which has already been mentioned. And under that case, it states that trial counsel should be making an accused should be giving an accused a full awareness of their rights at the time of the rights advisements. Trial counsel is not allowed to engage in deceit or deception at the time of rights advisements.
Okay, but the judge found no deceit and also found that the Article 31 rights were correctly given.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're not disputing that, are you, her findings?
I'm not disputing that the Article 31 rights were given in accordance with their prescribed manner. No, Your Honor. And also, not that there was necessarily deceit per se, but there was a misleading in the sense that in order to be truthful in reading of the rights, you have to make someone fully aware of their rights. Trial counsel failed, to the extent that this court finds that Airman Hawthorne has to be aware of his immunity in order for it to take effect. Colonel Bechtold was stating that trial counsel had engaged in an incomplete rights advisement, that he had a duty to inform.
But is there any case law to support that?
Only the statement that trial counsel has a duty to make Airman Hawthorne fully aware of his rights, and he held back the rights related to immunity. That would be a right that would be unique to Airman Hawthorne and not something that would be obviously considered in most 31 rights advisements, Your Honor.
But wait a minute. If you're saying you have to inform him of the immunity, aren't you in essence saying, I got a search warrant in one hand and I get a consent form in the other, take your pick? Because then that makes it inevitable that he's got to talk. What kind of consent is that?
Well, Your Honor, obviously it's Airman Hawthorne would have been protected at that point, obviously. So, there, exactly as you're stating, Your Honor, there, by advising him of the immunity, it obviously would have taken effect. And so by holding that trial counsel had a responsibility to advise him of these rights, Colonel Bechtold stating that even if this court or some other court found due to a lack of case law that immunity requires some type of knowledge on the part of Airman Hawthorne, which I don't believe is
knowledge, but I think that would have initiated voluntariness, correct?
Well, yes, Your Honor. But then voluntariness is obviously not required at that point once he's received immunity.
Correct.
Yes, Your Honor.
So how would informing them of the immunity make it voluntary?
Well, it would create an impossibility, obviously, Your Honor.
Okay, I just want to, all right.
Yes, Your Honor. But this case is really about command authority and about the fact that we don't limit the 12th Air Force commander's authority. He'd been requested for Hippocrat immunity. He didn't grant Hippocrat immunity by the plain language. The government's entire argument suggests limiting that command authority when the President of the United States has granted commanders that authority, not attorneys, and Colonel Bechtold did not abuse her discretion by upholding the 12th Air Force commander's authority to grant Airman Hawthorne immunity. Unless there's any further question, that.
Thank you, Major Kirk.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Porterfield.
To be clear, Your Honor, the commanding authority here does not lose his discretion. He does not lose his command authority. No one else usurped his authority to grant immunity. He retained the ultimate decision on whether to refer charges against Airman Hawthorne in this case, or anyone else involved, for that matter, Airman Flanner and Airman Foley. I would like to clarify our perspective of Capelli's response to your question regarding...
Hang on a second.
Yes, Your Honor.
With what you just said, isn't it the GCM who gives the immunity?
It is.
And chances are it's going to be the special court martial convening authority who would do the charges.
Who would do the charging, Your Honor. However, the GCMCA could has some role, Your Honor, in determining whether that person would ultimately go to trial or not.
Not necessarily in a special court, would he? I mean, not unless somebody went back up and asked him about it.
To effectuate If he was under the impression that...
I guess what I hear you saying is, appellate defense has argued you can't take the commander's authority away, and you're saying nobody took his authority away, but if they kept that immunity secret or hidden and didn't tell the accused, the appellee,
right,
and then they decided to court-martial him in a special court. If they didn't talk to the GCM, he would never know. So his authority has been taken away.
Well, I suppose I should just clarify, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'd like to refocus and make it clear through responding to your question to Appellee regarding the command-directed ear analysis.
Okay.
The command-directed ear analysis, Appellee distinguished it in saying that it's not an immunity in order. But it is the same situation insofar as the government's ability to use the obtained evidence, the obtained statement from the accused. So in a command-directed situation, of course consent is the goal. Miranda v. Burbine, which appellant cites, which supports in all counts the government's position here, Appellee, I apologize, cites, the consent is the goal. And so asking for consent has, at the outset, in a warrant situation, in a command-directed situation, in this situation, has always been the goal. It is the goal in balancing the societal interest in convicting the accused, the violators of the law, and in the individual's right against self-incrimination. If the accused does not waive his rights, if he does not consent, then in a command-directed situation, the government would be limited in what it could do with the statement. Again, a situation balancing the right of the state and the right of the individual. The same exists here when you have an immunity in order. The government would be limited in what it could do with the statements that were obtained. Both involve a situation where, in the presence of a compelled statement, the government is unable to use that evidence against the accused because he's not doing it knowingly, intelligently, voluntarily, because he's doing it in a commanded way or a coerced way, and no such coercion exists in this case. Even Castigar and Mapes, both of those cases, neither of those cases, I should say, deal with the issue of whether immunity was granted in the first place. They deal with the question of to what extent it was involved in the decision to prosecute, not with whether immunity was, whether the statement itself was in fact immunized, whether the statement was made by the accused under the impression it would not be used against him. That is not the case here. And Appellee cites, among the seven cases cited yesterday, Lewis and Caminetti, for the proposition that the plain language should rule unless it would lead to an absurd result. And as this court is well aware, that pen-to-paper effectiveness standard that the judge expanded the law to be would be an absurd result. For law enforcement to be held responsible for an accused's confession because the convening authority had signed a sheet of paper would be an expansion of the law. And in Moran, the Supreme Court refused to do that. Even in a situation where there was evidence of deceit by the police in interfering with the attorney's attempt to get in touch with her client. And in that case, the court, uncomfortable with the ethics involved, said it would be an expansion and it would be unfair because at the end of the day, it all turns on the state of mind of the accused. And the state of mind of the accused, the only thing that's required is, was he made aware of his rights and did he understand the consequences of giving up those rights? Article 31 was designed to answer those questions. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. Understand that your rights, your statement, any statements made by you will be used against you. The judge found that the accused was informed of all of these things. The accused knew his statement would be used against him and nonetheless testified. And so this, what Appellee is asking, what the military judge ultimately did here was expand Fifth Amendment protections under Article 31 and Miranda beyond what any court has previously held. Because from Cook v. Orser, Chernovig, Zabkowski, they all decide immunity based on a compulsion, based on a reliance. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that unlike Lane, there was ultimately no testimony at trial, one of the conditions of the immunity. There was ultimately no testimony because that turned into a guilty plea.
Counsel, if this court were to decide that the appellee had immunity, it seemed at the trial level, the trial counsel there basically conceded that they had improperly used an immunized statement in the decision to prosecute, therefore the case should be dismissed. What is your position on that?
On whether case should be dismissed?
Yes.
Well, Your Honor, from the government's perspective, to the extent that there was involvement in the decision of prosecutor, was involvement by the trial counsel, as has been done in the past, a new trial counsel could be appointed, a new convening authority could determine whether to prefer charges. There was enough evidence if the line is drawn in the sand at the point prior to the questioning of the accused, a prosecution could still take place, removing the parties that existed at the time.
So the remedy being allow a rehearing?
Yes, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude? I see that my time has expired.
You may.
This is a simple case of hip pocket immunity. At no point was the accused under the impression that his statement would not be used against him. For these reasons and those set forth in our brief, the United States respectfully requests that the military judge's dismissal be set aside and remand the case for further proceedings.
Thank you, Major Porterfield. Thank you, counsel, for those arguments on this apparently novel topic. We will issue our opinion in due course. Court is adjourned.